I'd now invite your attention to our brother Andrew as he addresses us, Daniel's friends, resisting the world's pressures in you.
My dearly beloved brethren and sisters, and my dear young people. In our last study, we saw that tragic figure of Jeremiah, who experienced so much sorrow and anguish in his life. But who around him and around Josiah, his great friend and confidant, there accumulated a number of younger men who were on fire with the word of Yahweh. And 3 years after the death of Josiah, when Jeremiah was about 40, his word was vindicated as being right, despite all the cries around him that Babylon would never come down and never touch that city. But the mighty Babylonian war machine was on the move 3 years after Josiah died. And Nebuchadnezzar moved in, and at the Battle of Carchemish, head-on hit Egypt and defeated Pharaoh Necho, and moved straight down into the coastal plain heading for Jerusalem and sieged it. And Jehoiakim at the time was a puppet to Egypt, and very quickly he changed allegiance and was put under tribute to Babylon. But that was not where it ended. The temple was ransacked by Nebuchadnezzar's officers. They took everything of value. All the vessels of the house of Yahweh were carted off to Babylon and placed in the houses of the gods of the Babylonians. But they also handpicked the cream of Judah's young men. Come to Daniel chapter 1. Verse 3. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, that is, spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favoured and skilful in wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had the ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. There must, young people and brethren and sisters, there must have been in that cohort that were hand-picked at that time from, did you notice, the king's seed and the princes, there must have been some who were very strongly influenced by Josiah. Josiah had only been dead for 3 years. And in his court in Jerusalem, there was growing up a youth group who were alive with the word of Yahweh. Jeremiah and other prophets had stirred them up. And with the example of Josiah before them, they were enthused to try and turn that nation around. But as soon as Josiah died, as we saw the other night, all hope of that ever happening was lost. The breath of the nation, as Jeremiah called him, was gone. The nation was a corpse, just rotting and rotting and rotting until Nebuchadnezzar finally finished it off a few years later. But here we find Nebuchadnezzar handpicking individual young men. Look at how they're described in verse 4. Well-favoured, intelligent, able to stand in the king's palace. He was after the cream of that nation. And these are called in verse 4, the start of verse 4, children. The word is used in the scriptures of anything from children to youths to young men. And it probably refers to teenagers, those in their late teens. And so these children whom he picked in the prime of their life at around 18 or 19 were carted off into Babylon. Babylon had a very clearly enunciated policy of integration and assimilation. They were very, very cunning psychologists. And they figured that If you were ever going to keep nations under subjection, what you had to do when you took them over is to mix up their people with yours. Mix them and have a good influence of Babylonian ways in there so that they forgot about their gods, they forgot about their culture, and they became Babylonians, whether they were in the lands that had been taken over captive or whatever. And he put Babylonians into the lands that he took captive, and he brought some of them into Babylon. That was only part of his policy. The second part of his policy was to handpick the intelligentsia of a nation and to train them in the ways of Babylon so that they might then influence their own people, both in the land of their captivity and back in their own national place of origin. And so we find that this method that Nebuchadnezzar was skilled at using throughout his campaigns and throughout his time as king was based on two fundamental principles. They tried to make those who were taken captive conform to Babylonian thinking and Babylonian behaviour. And we know exactly what happens here in verse 5. The king, once those young captives were brought into the realm, the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years at the end thereof they might stand before the king. It was his clear intention to have these as the prime young counsellors around him that had been so indoctrinated by Babylonian ways. They'd been given absolutely everything they could ever want. They'd come from a country that just did not have everything that it wanted, because it was in tribute to other countries, to Egypt at the time, in the case of Judah. But they were given the very, very best, the most appealing food, drink, access to Babylon's universities, and all the wisdom and learning was at their feet. All they had to do was to soak it up. But that wasn't all. They not only had their diet changed, they had their dress changed, they had their language changed, they had their environment changed, they had the source of their education changed, and to top it all off, they even changed their names in order that their personalities might never be the same as they were before. And it's very interesting to see, while there is some dispute about the actual meaning of some of their Babylonian names, it's very interesting to see that every one of the four friends that we find mentioned here in verses 6 and 7 of Daniel 1, that is Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, all have as part of the meaning of their name Yahweh or Ael. They had come from godly families who had so named their children to reflect their godly thinking. But the Babylonians named them, and if you have a look at the names that are there on the overhead at the moment, every single name that they gave to those four lads involved the name of one of Babylon's gods. There was a distinct and deliberate policy here to wipe out any cultural link, any link at all with the religion and life and behaviour of the nations from which these men came. Now, they were put in an exceedingly difficult situation. I don't think that just reading Daniel chapter 1, we perhaps at times understand quite how dangerous and difficult that was. Daniel certainly understood, and so did his friends come to understand that, just how dangerous it was. You see, everything that was being done for them, they were being given everything on a plate. They were being treated like great lords walking in, as princes of a realm that just had absolutely anything they wanted at the click of their fingers. If they said they wanted this food or that, they wanted this tutor or that, they got it. And everything that was being done to them appealed to their own pride. They were being told that all they had to do was put their mind to things and they would go a very long way up the hierarchy of the greatest nation on earth. They could be rulers. They could be second in the realm of the great and mighty Babylon. They could easily have deceived themselves into thinking, young people, that, well, it wasn't of their making that got them there. They'd been taken into captivity. They were put here by God. Surely they should make the best of the situation and just do whatever that was asked of them. You know, our young people today are under exactly that same pressure. There's an attempt to change personality. There's an attempt, a very strong attempt, to make our young people conform to Babylon's lifestyle. The world around us is encouraging by its environment and by its education, and the two things that Nebuchadnezzar used. It's encouraging a broad, rounded, balanced education. Oh, it sounds very nice, doesn't it, brethren and sisters? But underpinning the whole of our education scheme at the moment, and for some years it has been the same, is a humanistic base where God has removed from the realm of rational discussion. And other gods, in fact, are substituted for the one true God who created all. Other gods like success, achievement, sport, all substituted in place of the one true God who is the source of all intellectual reasoning and wisdom and moral might. And the whole of our education system that our children are immersed in day by day is man-centred, not God-centred. And especially is that true in the realm of the social areas, the social sciences. And there's many things that our children come up against every day of their lives when they're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it sounds to them all very plausible, all very reasonable. They don't see anything wrong with what's being told them. It just seems to make sense. But it seems to make sense because we're all made of flesh and so are they. And without some godly external influence in their minds, it just all makes sense. You know, and the consequences of the underpinning of humanism in all of our education society is bringing the whole of the Western world to its knees. There is no question of that. The consequences of this form of thinking, brethren and sisters and young people, and take note of this, is a push for personal rights. That's where that's coming from. The importance of the individual and what they themselves think. The equality of opportunity for women with men. Everybody's opinion is just as important as everybody else's. Our children at 4, 5, 6 are having that drummed into their heads. And if you can't see that coming out in your children at school, be thankful. Because there's an awful lot of our children in our young people's groups and in our Sunday schools who are already reflecting that thinking. Make no mistake. And democracy is supreme. The God of this world. Everything relies on democracy. It's the be all and end all. The voice of the people. But there's this spirit of madness, as it's termed in Revelation 16, that's driving the nations and bringing them to Armageddon. And one day, that spirit is going to be on the opposite side to Christ. There is a very deliberate design, very deliberate design in the education system of this world that is challenging,
with an attempt to eradicate biblical morality. You might think that's an overstatement. There are writers around and educators who are alive in this state who will openly state that. And it's in our workplaces, it's in our schools, it's in our universities. And it's incredibly important for our young people, incredibly important for our young people that are going off to a university in these days to know where they're going before they go. To have sorted out their lives and set a direction so that they clearly understand the issues of life before they're thrown in to that evil environment. It may be necessary for some of our young people, in terms of their jobs or whatever, to go on to tertiary study. And perhaps what's happening in society, it's becoming increasingly so for some of our young people. But it's also becoming increasingly important that our young people think seriously, younger and younger, about the issues of life. Look at verse 8. But Daniel, in this circumstance, purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he made a request to the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And that word purposed there is translated elsewhere as rehearsed. He rehearsed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's meat. He told himself over and over again and reinforced in his own mind what was right and that he couldn't be defiled with the king's meat. He wasn't going to partake of all that this society that he'd just been lobbed into was there to offer. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, what he didn't say, isn't that interesting to notice what he didn't say as well as what he did? He didn't say, oh, well, I'll give it a go, it can't really hurt, and we'll have a look at and compare it at the end. What absolute folly that would have been. He purposed in his heart when he saw the policy. He saw what Babylon was out to do. And he said, I am not going to do it. And he made request respectfully to the prince of the eunuchs, who in fact, as we know, accepted his request. And it turned out that he proved himself and his friends to be 10 times better than all of those that had been on the official diet of the king. You know, it's never ever wise counsel to taste of Babylon's food in order to make a choice between Babylon and the truth. Never is it a wise choice to do that. Because, young people, as soon as we've tasted of what Babylon has to offer, we've already in a position where we won't be able to make a choice anymore. Already things will become clouded. It's never ever a good idea to taste of Babylon first in order that we might make a choice. But I wonder whether you've ever noticed in Daniel, as we read through Daniel chapter 1, that Daniel himself as an individual, though we know that it talks about Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah as well in that chapter, how many of you have noticed that Daniel is very dominant in that chapter? In fact, that verse we just read, verse 8, it's talking about Daniel himself. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile, and he goes to the prince of the eunuchs and asks that he might not defile himself. He. Now, we know that the other friends of Daniel were likewise right behind Daniel and supporting everything he did. But it was just like that, with Daniel out the front and his friends supporting him. And you read through all of Daniel chapter 1 and you'll find that that's in fact the picture that we get. Daniel is obviously a leader, a very intelligent and capable young man who knew exactly where he was going. Now, it's not to deny that the other three friends who were around him and supported him were not also faithful young men. Of course they were, we know that, and it's proved a little later on. But he was the spokesman. In fact, in verse 8, verse 9, verse 10, verse 11, verse 17, and verse 21, Daniel stands out in front of all the others. And the other thing to notice before we move on is that Daniel chapter 1 really concentrates on all of these four young men and only calls them by their Hebrew names, apart from telling us that they had their names changed by the Babylonians. On all other occasions, it uses their Hebrew names. And then we come to chapter 2 with the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, and we know that very well and what happened. And Daniel, as a result, was elevated because of his interpretation of that dream. And again, it's Daniel, not the others. It's Daniel who was in that position. I'd like you to come to the end of Daniel chapter 2, verse 48. And read this very carefully. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many gifts and made him rule over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. If you read that quickly, you missed the point. Did you notice? Daniel still called by his Hebrew name. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have got their Babylonian names. They were not called by their Babylonian names in chapter 1, but now they are. And all the way through chapter 3, they have Babylonian names without exception. What's that saying? Well, it appears that Daniel had risen to such an important post that no one could tell him what his name was going to be. And he retained his name as his original Hebrew name. But the other three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, even though they were raised to a position of importance, were still subordinate and were still being called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by Nebuchadnezzar himself. Now, that's interesting to notice. We come to chapter 3, and at this stage, those three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were probably in their early 20s at this stage, and Daniel is not even mentioned in Daniel chapter 3. They are always, as we said, mentioned by their Babylonian names. Nebuchadnezzar clearly had not given up on his original policy of integration and conformity. You see, the changing of those names were meant to reflect a different personality. And Nebuchadnezzar was not going to give up easily on that. He hadn't even tried to persist with that with Daniel, but now there's psychological warfare. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't have to go browbeating them all the time. All he has to do is keep on calling them by their Babylonian names as opposed to their Hebrew names. And really what Babylon was doing, and Nebuchadnezzar in particular, young people, he was taking another tack. They had been proved in their integrity in chapter 1 to be 10 times better than anything else, any of the others that had been under that test. But the world doesn't give up that easily in trying to make the young intellectuals conform to its thinking and its behaviour. You know, I believe, young people, that the events of chapter 3 of Daniel are even more relevant. And it's the reason that we've chosen tonight to concentrate on chapter 3 as opposed to chapter 1. It's not that there are no lessons in chapter 1 for young people. There certainly are. There's lessons for us all. But chapter 3, I believe, is even more relevant to young people generally. And I'll tell you why. We find in chapter 3 that Daniel is not there. In other words, the leader is not present. Now that's important. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are always mentioned together in chapter 3. Always, without exception. They are never ever separated. There is no clear leader amongst any of those three, apart from that they're named the same way each time. But they're always kept together. And here we're presented with three ordinary Christadelphian young people. Now, I think that's very important. They had grown up in the truth, They're in a strange land where they didn't really belong, and there's enormous pressures to conform. And when they first got there, there was a strong character like Daniel who influenced them and encouraged them to stand up for what was right. And they talked about the Bible and Jeremiah's prophecies with Daniel. And now Daniel's not there. And they're, in their own eyes, just ordinary young people. What are they going to do? They're without the support of a leader. They're without the support of their family. They're without the support of the ecclesia. They're just three young people who have to make a decision themselves. And young people, that's the situation that you and I find ourselves in almost every day of our lives, living in the middle of Babylon. And we don't always have a Daniel standing alongside us. And we don't always have our fathers or mothers or support standing alongside us every time a test comes upon them. You know, I believe, young people, that Daniel chapter 3 is an essential chapter of the Bible for every young teenager to come to grips with. If you don't know anything much about this and you haven't marked up some of the principles out of Daniel chapter 3, make it a determination after tonight to do it. Because you are fighting the exact issues that are in this chapter. There is a king out there who is determined to make you bow the knee, just as determined as Nebuchadnezzar was in the days when Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego stood. And this chapter is an amazing piece of scripture. It is so different from anything else that appears in the book of Daniel. I guarantee that if I asked everyone in this hall tonight just to get a piece of paper and for you to write down the story that's contained in Daniel chapter 3, because we've just read it and we've all known it since we were this high, if we grew up in the truth, we've all heard the story at Sunday school, and we all know it. Our children love the story. It's a dramatic story. I guarantee that if I asked you to write down on paper the story of this chapter of Daniel and his three friends in the fiery furnace, there wouldn't be one single person in this hall who wrote it down like this. Not one. I wouldn't write it like this. The repetition in this chapter is absolutely astounding. And on the Bible marking sheet, there's a list of some of those things that you can follow through. But we're going to have to read carefully. You know, we must have read Daniel chapter 3 so many times. We're so familiar with the story. But when we are familiar with things, we read straight over very important principles. And whenever the scripture repeats and continually repeats over and over and over again something in very short succession, we've got to sit up and listen. And the divine mind has recorded something in here that's attempting to make us sit up and listen very carefully, because there's some essential issues of life contained here. Let's come to verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and the breadth thereof was 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. All very interesting. And so we start the story. But there are at least three very clear connections back to chapter 1. One of them is very obvious on the surface. The other two may not be quite so obvious. The one that's very obvious is that he made an image of gold. The word image there is exactly the same word that's used for image in chapter 2 of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw. But this time it's all of gold. And that has to be a challenge, doesn't it? Because the image that Nebuchadnezzar, of all people, saw, and now it's Nebuchadnezzar setting up this new one, the one that Nebuchadnezzar saw only had a head of gold, and he was told what that meant. Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. You are the crowning pinnacle of the kingdoms of men, but under you there is an inferior kingdom that's going to take over for you, and you are not going to keep on going forever. That was the clear message which was given to him by Daniel. And now, straight after that, Nebuchadnezzar sets up an image of pure gold from head to foot. Now, if that wasn't an open and direct challenge to the vision which he'd already seen and had interpreted for him, I don't know what was. So it's set in that setting. But there's more to it than that. It tells us that Nebuchadnezzar set it up. It wasn't just his counselors or princes. He didn't go and get those who were over this province of Babylon to do it. Do you know who was over the province of Babylon? Well, the end of chapter 2 says that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were over the province of Babylon. And now he goes straight over their heads and sets up in the province that he's given them to rule over, he sets up this image without their knowledge. Why did he do it? Obviously, he knew what they'd think of him because they were friends of Daniel. And that is repeated, if you think that's unimportant, that phrase, he, Nebuchadnezzar that is, he set it up, occurs 9 times in this chapter. Now, if we didn't know after verse 1 that it was Nebuchadnezzar that set up, we'd be rather dull. But we're told time and time again, every time we meet that image, that it was the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And it's repeated over and over again. This is quite clearly a very direct challenge in the face of that image which he'd seen. But there's something else that might not be on the surface so amazing. The chapter starts with Nebuchadnezzar the king. Do you know that title, Nebuchadnezzar the King, doesn't occur outside of this chapter, apart from verse 1 of chapter 4. And between verse 1 of chapter 3 and verse 1 of chapter 4, it occurs 9 times. It never occurs outside there. Never have we got Nebuchadnezzar and the King put together as a formal, pompous, official, powerful title. But now, as if to emphasize that it's Nebuchadnezzar, the supreme king of the world, it's repeated over and over and over ad nauseum with deliberate intent. That's how this starts. And if you don't think that that's the intention of that title, you come to chapter 4 and verse 1, the only other place outside this chapter that it occurs, and we read, Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, languages that dwell on the face of the earth, in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. And so he goes on and says. So he's commanding the attention of the then known world and drawing attention to himself as the supreme might. That's exactly what that image was meant to portray. He had that intention to draw the attention of all the world to his might and his supremacy, and get all the world to bow down. So it's a testimony to his arrogance and to his self-importance. But we just read straight over a number of other things in verse 1 there. For example, the dimensions of the image and its location. You see, it was 60 cubits by 6 cubits. Anyone that knows anything about the Bible would have to immediately see the connection with flesh there. 6 being the number of flesh. But it's an impressive image, a very impressive image. Now, this image was 9 stories high. And where did he set it? In the middle of all Babylon's high-rise buildings? No, out on the plain of Dura, where a 9-story image would look amazingly impressive when you walked into it from miles away. You would see this glistening in the sun, this gigantic image. When everyone from all over his province was drawn there, it was there to impress the eyes. Nebuchadnezzar was no fool. He might have been a selfish, self-centered man, but he was no fool. And there was the symbol of flesh to be glorified and worshipped. And what a challenge that was to the might of Yahweh. Set in the plain of Dura. The word Dura means a circle, which really has the idea of eternity. And there he thought he was going to set up his kingdom for eternity. And look who he called, verse 2. Nebuchadnezzar the king sent together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the provinces. rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Repetitious, isn't it? Why didn't he say? He gathered together all the intelligentsia and all the rulers from all over his realm. Why didn't he say that? Well, he mentions them every one by name to impress us with just how many there were and how important were all their titles, and that from the highest to the lowest of all his rulers were there. And verse 3 repeats all that same list again and tells us that they all, without exception, came. This is very impressive. Everybody was coming and prepared to conform to the invitation of this great king. Where the emphasis was on grandeur and pomp and ceremony to impress the flesh. And they all stood in front, verse 3. Right at the end of verse 3 we find, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The word stood before means to stand in front of. And this is where all of these captains and judges and treasurers stood, right down the front, right at the foot of this image. So they're staring up at this 9-story high image, a massive structure. And behind them are countless millions of people, hundreds of thousands probably of people that had been gathered and called to witness this inaugural ceremony, where Nebuchadnezzar himself was going to be worshipped in the image that he'd made. And just think, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are right down the front. With all of those captains and judges and treasurers right in the front row, where everybody, no matter where they stood, could see them. And we find in verse 4, and herald cried aloud, or as the margin says, with might, to you it's commanded, O people, nations and languages. And so he goes on to tell them all of the details of what they had to do. When they heard the sound of all of these instruments, they had to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had made. But it was a command, did you notice, in verse 4? Unto you it's commanded. There wasn't any option. There wasn't any opportunity for conscientious objection. And I'd like you to notice, just in passing, and we'll come back to this in a moment, who he commanded that law to. It says, O people, nations, and languages. Just make a mental note of that for the moment. And then we find in verse 5 that this was the command, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar hath set up. And it goes on and on, repeats. And if they don't fall down, whosoever falleth not down and worship the same hour shall be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So it's not only a command, there's also real might to this law that's going out. And so there was a signal when they were to worship the flesh. There was a signal, and that signal was music. 6 instruments. So you can imagine what kind of music it was. It was there to arouse the flesh, to incite the flesh, to bow down and to glorify an image of a man who thought he'd been elevated into heaven. Above Yahweh in the heavens. That's what it was all about. And music is a very, very powerful medium. A very powerful medium. And it was used on this occasion by Nebuchadnezzar to make all peoples of his realm to fall down on their knees and worship the flesh. And if they didn't, if there was no voluntary response, then they would get a little help, a little taste of the fiery furnace. And perhaps that might convince them to drop onto their knees. And for the majority, if any had stood up, it certainly would have helped. And did you notice that that furnace is not just called a furnace? It's called a burning, fiery furnace. This was no ordinary furnace. And did you notice in the record it's mentioned 8 times? That's very significant. We'll come back to that later. But it's mentioned 8 times. And so, if a person refused to bow down and worship the flesh, what was going to happen? They would be sacrificed to Babylon's god of the fire. And Nebuchadnezzar would still be supreme. He would not allow any challenge. He had within his hand the power to do anything he wanted. Men's lives danced on his palm. If he said, "That's the end of you," that was the end. Or so he thought. And we find in verse 7, "Therefore, at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, and all kinds of music," see, they're all repeated, all 6 of them repeated again. All, underline it, young people, all the people, the nations and the languages, there's that same phrase, fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. All his policies are working 100%. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, has now got everyone on their knees, just where he wanted them. Or so he thought. I want you to think, young people, of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're in the front row. And they're standing there with everyone else. And the music starts. And they see all around them people starting to go down. And the music reaches a crescendo. And it's getting louder and louder. And they look out the corner of their eye and they can't see anyone else standing. And they look around and there's no one else anywhere standing. What do you think their knees were feeling like? Ever felt weak in the knees? Well, I guarantee that day they were. They could have easily rationalized that. Easily rationalized. They could have said in their minds, "Well, really, we've only just been honored by Nebuchadnezzar, and we probably should be thankful for that. We oughtn't to offend him. Of course, if we do bow down, in this case, it wouldn't really mean that we were worshipping his gods, and we could explain that to him afterwards so that he understood that we weren't worshipping his gods. And anyway, what's the use of really just sacrificing our lives for such a pointless exercise? I mean, after all, what would that really achieve? Surely we've got a greater work to do here in Babylon. Surely we can encourage the young captives. We know something about what Daniel said. Surely, well, let's just go down and we'll explain to Nebuchadnezzar afterwards." Sounds plausible, doesn't it? I wonder how many of us would have taken that line. They knew that to go, to stand upright, young people, they knew it meant certain death. And remember this, that they didn't know the end of this story like we do. All they knew was that Babylonians were awfully ruthless. Whatever they said, they meant, and it didn't matter about men's lives. Life was awfully cheap in the hands of a potentate like Nebuchadnezzar. And they'd seen that happen in their own country. And with that knowledge, it was not easy to stand up and be counted. And they counted the cost, young people, they counted the cost. And the cost was their lives. Nothing less. It was their lives. And there are many other faithfuls through many generations who have faced exactly that same situation and have counted the cost and have lost their lives. Now, they knew that Babylon's days were numbered. They knew that because they'd been in touch with Jeremiah before they left. And they knew that Jeremiah had prophesied 70 years and they would come out of the land. They knew Babylon's days were numbered. And they based their decision to stand up straight on what they knew Jeremiah, by the word of Yahweh, had said, and not on what they saw with their eyes and heard with their ears. Young people, that's what faith is all about. To make decisions in everyday life that are based on what we know and believe are right, despite what our ears and our eyes are telling us. Because very often what we see and we hear are very, very deceiving signals. Now, we're faced, and young people, you know that you're faced with some very difficult situations at school, at universities, and sometimes in the workplace. You're faced with a pressure almost daily to conform to this age or not. There's a decision and you're asked to stand up or drop onto your knees. You're asked sometimes and have pressure put on you to go to worldly parties. What do? Do you say no or say yes? Do you stand up or do you get on your knees? You're faced with decisions in the schoolyard to join in with all the crude jokes that are going around and to have a snigger. Do you stay there? Do you stand up or go on your knees? Well, learn to stand up and to think of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego before that image with hundreds of thousands of people behind watching them. And you know, we mentioned a moment ago this little phrase, O people, nations and languages. And it was all the people, nations and languages in verse 7 that had fallen down onto their knees. You know, that phrase is used in Revelation to describe all the world. Revelation 5, without turning to it, and in verse 8 and 9 says, Thou hast redeemed us out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. And now we've got all the peoples, nations, tongues bowing down. And they're going to have to stand out of that. And that's who God's looking at. Because in the end, counted amongst the redeemed are those who've come out of all peoples, nations and tongues, who didn't fit and didn't conform to all their ways because they belong to a society that was very different. And when they were in the midst of a situation that they were very uncomfortable with, they stood upright. Verse 8. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Notice the term. The word accuse in the Septuagint is diabolo, from which we get to the Greek diabolos, falsely accuse. And out of jealousy, they accused these Jews before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar may not have even known, with such a vast crowd. Who did notice were all of those who were standing alongside and all around. And they'd seen these three men just raised to great prominence overnight. And they hated them and what they stood for and the fact that they didn't really conform to Babylonian ways. And look at the accusations. You would expect them to go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, O Nebuchadnezzar, there are three men who are Jews who didn't bow down to your image. You know, they said two other things before they said that. Notice what they said in verse 12. The three things are these: that they haven't regarded the king, that they have not served the king's gods. So they're introducing all these other things. And then that they worship not the golden image. And it's very interesting that their contemporaries very clearly knew a lot more about them than what they saw on that day. They knew that they did not serve Babylonian gods. Now, how did they know that? Because just them bowing down there on that day to that image of Nebuchadnezzar
was not going to merely tell them that. Clearly, they had spoken to these others before. And verse 13 goes on to say, "Then Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king." Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar even do that? Why didn't he say, "Well, take them and throw them in the furnace. That's what we got the furnace for. Don't you understand?" He didn't say that. He said, "Bring them here," even though he is furious that anyone should possibly stand up against him. And so we find that before this enraged king, we find these three godly young men. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 14, spake and said unto them, "Is it true," or as it probably more carefully should be rendered, "is it with design or is it with purpose, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up?" But he doesn't wait for an answer. He just assumes that it was not on purpose. And there in itself is psychological pressure that's very difficult to resist. And young people, we're faced with that sort of psychological pressure all the time, where people might throw us a question and not wait for an answer and just go on assuming that we're going to conform. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar did. Verse 15. And pressure is building. "Now if ye be ready at that time, ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, six again, and all kinds of music, and ye fall down and worship the image which I've made, well, but if not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." They knew all that. Why was he giving them a second chance? Well, I believe he feared them. And he knew in the back of his mind that what he was doing was a challenge to Yahweh. And that these men truly were friends of Daniel and servants of the true God. And as perhaps a sign of a guilty conscience on the part of Nebuchadnezzar starting to emerge then. But he rides roughshod straight over that, and he doesn't stop with just giving the previous command. He continues and says at the end of verse 15, "And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" End of story. Get back in front of the image. And now they've been graciously given another chance, another opportunity. But all it turned out to be, young people, was another real pressure. Because now Nebuchadnezzar looks like he's the good guy. He's the one that's virtually saved their lives from the furnace and said, "Well, I'm going to give you another chance. Don't you understand? My mercy is such that I'm going to give you another chance. Now let's not have any more of this nonsense. Right back and we'll try again." How would you go? Opening your mouth in the face of that. But you see, they'd been encouraged, because Nebuchadnezzar himself had raised the contest to the level of Yahweh versus the gods of Babylon. And there was a stimulus to the faith. Were they going to worry about Nebuchadnezzar's fire god, or Yahweh, the maker of heaven and earth? And in their mind, there was no doubt. And so in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said unto the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter." It's a poor translation. It really means we need not say a word in answer to that question, as another translation has it. Verse 17, "If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up." They weren't being arrogant or rude, young people. They just had tremendous faith to stand up and to say, that they believed that there was a God who could deliver. And did you notice they didn't say he would? They have a God whom they serve who is able to deliver. And if it was his will, he could. But if it wasn't, then let him clearly know that they were not, under any circumstances, going to still bow down and worship that image or his gods. You know, I believe it's almost written into the record here that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego had discussed that situation amongst themselves before that moment. Did you notice in verse 7, after we read from verse 4 onwards about what the command was, in verse 7 it says, therefore, at that time when all the people heard the sound. So there was clearly a time lag between when the herald came around and told everyone what they had to do and when the music actually started, when the ceremony began. And those three faithful young men would have been very concerned about the situation they were in, and no doubt had talked carefully and quickly together and had discussed all the issues involved and had got on their knees and prayed to the God of heaven and earth and had sought his guidance in this very difficult situation and stuck together and determined amongst themselves that they would stay together because they knew it was right. They'd made up their minds before the situation happened. Now, I believe if they hadn't made up their minds very clearly amongst themselves, that when it came and that music began, the whole emotion of that circumstance would have weakened their knees to such a point when they looked around and saw that everyone else was down, they too would have gone to their knees. You know, there's a very powerful lesson in that, young people. If we allow ourselves to walk out onto the plain of Jura in full sight of the glory of the flesh, of Babylon and all its might and all its gods, and we think that on the spur of the moment we're just going to be able to make the right decision, it's going to be the godly one every time, we are fooling ourselves. If we walk out onto that plain of Jura, if we have not prayerfully and carefully considered the dangers there and what we might do if we're caught in this situation or that, or what we might do to flee from this or that, or how we'll react to this or that, young people, we'll be on our knees before we can even think about it. The power in Babylon's psychological techniques will have us on our knees unless we very carefully prepare. Now, what I believe we have to do, young people, with the depth of wickedness that's in this world, is to think carefully about situations and issues, weigh it up, and talk about it with our friends who are godly, who know their Bibles, and open them together, and talk about things. Ask each other, what do you think God thinks about this? How do you think I should handle this? I came across this situation the other day, and I didn't know what to do, and I said yes to this, and afterwards I felt wretched about it. What do you think I should do? And ask older brethren. Talk to your peers. Open your Bibles. On your knees in prayer to the Father. That's what they did, I believe, out on the plain of Jura when they had very little time. It's no good our Bibles being shut in nice cases when we're out standing in front of that image and the music starts. A Bible is no good then. The Bible is only any good if it's affected our minds before that time. You know, never ever, young people, never ever underestimate the value of good, godly minded friends. These three are never separated in this record. Have you noticed that? Never separated. When they say something, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said. Does that mean that they cited in unison? I don't think so. But what it means is that there was no leader among there. They were all terrified of that situation, but they were godly enough to have worked out between them what they should do. And they encouraged each other and stood together upright, because they had good companions alongside them. You know, use your companions. Those young people who come from a situation where there are other young people in your ecclesia or in your surrounding, thank God for that. Never underestimate the privilege and the blessing of that, and use it. Verse 19. When Nebuchadnezzar, full of fury, then was Nebuchadnezzar, sorry, full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace one 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. 7 times hotter than was ever seen heated before, Rotherham says. And now they had a chance to change their minds. If they were quick. Because the king's face was distorted with rage, as the Hebrew actually means. And tragically, that last heating of the furnace makes many young people buckle. That last 7 times heating and the visual impact of that, as the pressure really comes on from a world who wants to make them conform, often just makes the little bit of difference that crumples their knees and takes them to the ground. Verse 20, and he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the very burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments were cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down. Not voluntarily. They fell down, bound, into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. What a frightening spectacle. You put yourselves in that situation, young people. They didn't know what was going to happen when they got in there. It was certain death for them. They were powerless, helpless, and all they could do was pray to the God of heaven. Verse 24 and 25 tells us that when they looked in, they saw that there was 4 men walking loose. And they'd thrown in 3 men that were bound. And there was a great enigma here. 3 bound had gone into the furnace, and now, as they peered through the flames from a distance, Nebuchadnezzar could see 4 men who were loose. And they didn't expect, let alone Nebuchadnezzar, but the 3 friends never ever in their wildest dreams expected an angel to appear in that furnace. They knew, as David had written many years before in Psalm 34, that the angel of Yahweh encamps around them that fears him and delivers them. But they didn't expect that God had to do a miraculous deliverance on that day. They understood by deliverance that in the end, when it came to the time of the kingdom, he would raise them again and they would stand with the faithful of all ages. But now, very literally, the angel of Yahweh was camping with them in the midst of that fire. Because they believed that Yahweh could deliver. And because they believed that he could, he did. Young people, that's a powerful lesson. Because they believed Yahweh could deliver, he actually did. And Yahweh doesn't change. It doesn't mean that you might get into a situation tomorrow or the day after and expect some miraculous deliverance. God won't necessarily work like that. But if you believe that he can deliver you out of circumstances and out of the grip of Babylon, he will. He will deliver. He is able, these friends told Nebuchadnezzar. And they came forth. They came forth at the beckon of Nebuchadnezzar out of that fire. And notice how he addressed them in verse 26. He said to them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. And he acknowledges in verse 28 the God of heaven and earth, and promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be seen and rulers over all of the province of Babylon. Well, that's a very interesting story, isn't it? But it's not the end. In fact, there's much, much more in Daniel chapter 3 that we're not going to spend a lot of time on. But there is a marvellous parable in this chapter about whose servants we really are. Verse 28 holds the key. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." You know, there's the issue. There it is in a nutshell, young people. And the issue is this, and I don't believe there is a more important issue for you as young people to come to grips with in your youth. Who are you going to serve? That was the issue that they were faced with. It's the issue that Nebuchadnezzar understood was being played out in that whole incident. You see, the word servant or service occurs in verse 12, verse 14, verse 17, verse 18, verse 26 to verse 28. They're all on the sheet. Check them out later. But Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. You'll either hold to the one and love the other, or it'll be vice versa. You cannot. It doesn't matter who you are. You can't serve two masters. And you have to make a choice. And if you don't make a choice, it'll be made for you. It's as simple as that. In life, you refuse to make a choice, and the choice is already made. But you have a choice if you want to make it. I'd like you to hold your hand in Daniel chapter 3 and come across to Romans 6. Because the issue of Romans 6 is whose servants are we going to be? And we know that Romans 6 speaks predominantly of baptism. But in Romans chapter 6 and at verse 12, here the Apostle Paul tells us very clearly to let not King sin, paralleled to King Nebuchadnezzar, let not King sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that ye should obey it in the lusts thereof. Obeying it in the lusts thereof, young people, is falling to our knees and doing what it says. Just as Babylon, in Babylon, the friends were asked to fall to their knees and to worship the image of King Nebuchadnezzar. Don't let King Sin reign. He will try all sorts of devious persuasions, all sorts of tricks, all sorts of things to try and get you to obey him. Just like Nebuchadnezzar tried to get those friends to obey him. But verse 13 and 14 are even more interesting. Neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto King Sin, but yield yourself unto God as those that are alive from the dead. Now look at the allusions here there are back to this incident in Daniel chapter 3. And your members as instruments of righteousness unto God. For King Sin shall not have dominion over you. He won't. He doesn't have to have dominion over you. It's your choice. And did you see the similarity of language? Hold your hand in Romans and just turn back to Daniel, which I still hope you've got. And look at verse 28 again. It says that in Nebuchadnezzar's words here, and he delivered his servants that trusted in him, have changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. It's the same language that Paul takes up about here, about yielding ourselves, our members as instruments of righteousness or unrighteousness to God. And then look at verse 16. Back in Romans we are now, verse 16. He says, "Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are, to whom ye obey." Whether of sin unto death or obedience unto righteousness. But it's whom you yield yourself to that you're under the dominion of. And that's very interesting. It's not who we say is our master, young people. That's what Paul is saying here. It's not whom we say our master is that's our true master. It's to whom we yield ourselves and our lives. That's the one that's our master. And it's either sin or it's God. It's as simple as that. There is no black and white. We can't try and grey it out in the middle. We are either servants of God or we are servants to King Sin. It's as simple as that. And King Sin is a very, very powerful monarch. What more powerful parallel could you ever have found in Scripture? Because Nebuchadnezzar was supreme monarch of the world. Everything he said went. And he didn't always have to use might. He used a lot of cunning and subtle means. His policy? Force everyone to bow down and worship the flesh. That was Nebuchadnezzar's policy, and King Sin has exactly the same policy. And what was his strategy? Nebuchadnezzar used grandeur and size and impressive things. All the majority, the mighty men all came and they all bowed down. That's a powerful, powerful tool. Peer pressure, the majority, is a powerful tool used by King Sin to make us bow down. And so are all the impressive, apparently permanent things we see around us. Oh, they look so, so permanent that we think King Sin is enthroned here forever. But it's all just in the appearances. But you know, there was another tool that King Nebuchadnezzar used that King Sin also uses, young people. And it was the music of the flesh. Remember there were six instruments? A music has a powerful emotional pull. And today's depraved pop culture that has corrupted millions upon millions of young minds around the world continues in exactly the same strategy of King Nebuchadnezzar of old. Today's pop culture ridicules anything that's decent, holy, good and right. And lords as virtues those things that are absolutely abhorrent and despicable. I would never counsel you, brethren and sisters, to go and listen to pop music that this world's children are listening to. It is horrific, to say the least. I've picked up at school cassettes and looked at the labels and my eyes have fallen out of my head. I couldn't even read the labels here tonight. Have made me sick to see what the titles of the songs are, let alone the content. And that's not an isolated piece of music in today's younger generation pop culture. It's intended to excite, to incite the flesh, to rebellion and free lust. End of story. And this world's advertisers and promoters know exactly that, and they're riding on a multi-billion dollar wave out of the lives of individual young people around this world who've become addicted to this filthy rubbish. Nebuchadnezzar tried exactly the same things. You know, Brother John Carter once said, "The mind is insensibly affected by the stream of thoughts passing through it." You imagine what this filthy rubbish is doing to the minds of this generation's young people who have the plug-in drug in their ears and walk around mesmerized hour after hour after hour of every day. We have children in their teens coming to school plugged in. They have it pulled out when they get to school. If it's not confiscated, it's plugged back in at recess time. And then it's pulled out again and plugged back in at lunchtime. It's pulled out, it's plugged back in lessons. It goes on and on. It's addictive. Young people, don't touch it. It will corrupt your minds. It's dulling the intelligence and sensitivity and moral power of a whole generation that is getting themselves ready to be destroyed by Christ and the saints. It's that serious. Nebuchadnezzar knew what music can do. The music of the flesh has to be avoided. It prevents thinking. Oh, it's a terrible thing. You know, I've had young people tell me, both at school and within the ecclesia, that they've tried to get off some of that stuff. I had a young lad at school tell me it was 3 years since he stopped listening to some horrendous heavy metal music. But he said, with almost tears in his eyes, it keeps coming back. I just see all these images all the time. I just keep thinking the words all the time. I just can't get rid of it. It just keeps coming back. And music's like that, isn't it? We teach our little children the books of the Bible to song because it's easy to learn. And they can just remember the tune and it all comes back. And this world's filth is being fed into the minds of a generation of young people and corrupting their intelligence and their moral faculties to the point where they won't be able to respond. What a tragedy of the first order. Young people, avoid it like the plague. Music changes not only our ability to think, but with corrupting and degrading sentiments, will change our behaviour. How do we get rid of it? I know this. I know this from talking to some of our young people, some of whom are here tonight. I know that some of them don't know how to get off it. They want to, but they don't know how. I wonder sometimes how, after going to a young people's class and being uplifted by consideration of some part of the Word of God and thrilling to that and talking amongst themselves afterwards, can jump into their car and turn on the filth of the world. Leave it off, young people. Leave it off. Make a determination to change and replace it with something. Replace it with something that's a bit more elevated, a bit more God-centered. Just try, even if you don't like listening to something like the Messiah or Mendelssohn's Elijah, just try. Just try for 15 minutes a day. Just try it. And do it every day for a fortnight. Just try it. And it just might surprise you that you actually can respond to it. And it actually is likeable. And it is actually elevating, as opposed to the degrading sentiments of most of today's pop music. But that wasn't the only other form of strategy that King Nebuchadnezzar and King Sin uses. There was a herald crying with might. With might. Oh, and there's a mighty strong voice around that's not going to give up. It's not going to give up, young people. Don't think it will. Saying to you every day, maybe not in these words, but in action, in attitude, it's saying to you, you decide what you want to do for yourself, and if you want to bow down, you bow down. And you stick up for your rights. And don't let some airy-fairy god in the sky, some concept, get in the way of what your body is telling you you should do. You know, there's young people within our young people's circle, brethren and sisters, who are talking now about their rights. Why haven't I got the right to do this or that? That should ring bells in our minds, warning bells. Why can't I? Surely it's my life and I can decide for myself what I want to do with my life. Now, if you open your ears, you'll hear that around the place. Not perhaps quite as in exaggerated form as I just said then. But you'll also hear, my opinion's just as important as you, yours. Anyway, what you're saying's only an opinion. Anyway. To a brother who might have been 60 years in the truth and has borne the heat and burden of the day. All around us, there are people on their knees. Their plans, their ambitions, their activities are all centred around satisfying the flesh and the worship and elevation of it. And the king's command is ever so simple. Ever so simple. All the king said was, just let go. Just relax. Can't hurt you. You can't study the Bible all the time. Just, why don't we just go out to the pictures? Just one night in the week. Surely that can't hurt. Don't be deceived. It's not easy to do what's right when others are doing wrong. And it's even harder, young people, to do what's right when other of our young people are doing wrong. But stand up straight. You can as easily, brethren and sisters as well, assess the effects that King Sin is having on us by what we do with our time, what we do with our money, what we do with our, where we go. I'm not trying to underestimate the pressures that are falling on our young people today. They're quite enormous, and the whole of the advertising industry is focusing on young, on youth, because they have disposable income. And they'll target them for dress. And young people feel as though they have to have brand names and particular trendy hairstyles, that they have to see this movie or go there or try this or experiment with drugs or experiment with sex. We've got to make up our minds, young people, before we go out on the plain of Dura. Whose servants are we? That's the issue. And, young people, I can tell you this, that decision has to be made very often before you're baptised. Because at 13, 14, you're going to be expected to know whose servants you are. And that's an awful responsibility that's falling on the shoulders of our children. And parents, help them to bear that. But we have this assurance, young people, and I'd like you to come to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. And at verse 12, we have this assurance. For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers, but in the face of the Lord, but the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. And who is he that will harm you if you be followers of that which is good? Who is there? And if ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye. But be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. Let me read that to you from the RSV. It says, but sanctify the Lord as Christ as Lord in your hearts, and be ready to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is within you, with meekness and fear, having a good conscience, that whereas they speak evil of you, as evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conversation in Christ. You see, the key is this, young people, to sanctify Christ as Lord, not King Sin. To sanctify in your heart Christ as Lord. And let not King Sin reign. And prepare for the day that you go out into the plain of Dura. And be ready with a hope that's within you, not in your Bible. It's in there for sure, but it's not going to do any good unless it's in you and you'll be able to stand. But when you make a stand, young people, brethren and sisters of age and experience know this only too well, that when we make a stand, the pressure won't decrease. It will often increase, just as it did in those days when Nebuchadnezzar stirred up that furnace until it was seven times hotter than it had ever been before. You know what the Apostle Paul said? He said, let all that live godly, that live godly, not profess, but live godly in Christ Jesus, shall suffer persecution. And it's the lot of all the faithful, as we've seen from a couple of our other studies. The lot of all God's faithful servants are going to have to walk this path. where there's pressure. But you know, pressure has a purpose. And here it's so beautifully explained. We're going to finish on this tonight. It is absolutely beautifully illustrated in this little parable. You see, those three young men were bound by King Sin and thrown into a furnace. And when they got into that furnace, you know what happened? The ropes burnt off. They were freed, and they came out and were elevated to the top of the kingdom. Now, we're in 1 Peter. You turn back a page to 1 Peter chapter 1. And these are words we must have read hundreds of times, but you think of them in this context. 1 Peter 1. It's talking about our lively hope in verse 3. Verse 6, wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you're in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honour at the appearing of Jesus Christ. What interesting words. Here, faith and gold are put alongside each other, and it's gold which perishes. And there was a golden image on the plain of Jura, and it's matched against faith. And he says, the trial of your faith is much more precious than gold that's going to perish, even though that faith is going to be tried in the fire, and that faith is going to go into the fire. And what's going to happen to it when it comes into the fire? It's going to be found under praise and honour at the appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ, and it's going to have its bounds freed, and it's going to be elevated into glory. Faith is going to do that. And in that little parable, that's exactly what it says. It says, the fire of trial is going to free us, brethren and sisters and young people, of the bondage of King Sin. Think of that. Verse 8. Whom, he says, talking of Christ, having not seen ye love, and in whom though ye now see him not, yet believing, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. And so that really is the essence of faith, isn't it? Seeing the unseen. Though we don't see now, yet believing and rejoicing with full of glory that one day we'll stand delivered, freed, saved through the power of a tried faith. What have we seen? That the world will always try to force conformity in its thinking and its ways and behaviour. Whilst we're in Babylon, if we're godly, trial will always be inevitable. But we've got to learn to stand up and do what's right, despite what the majority are doing. We are his servants to whom we obey. We have the choice. And God is able to deliver. If we believe he can, he will. Deliverance requires faith, courage, and determination by us all. Let's always be ready to give an answer of the hope that's within us and to make good use and thank God for the companions that he has given us.